of the course, and so this is kind of the time to talk about things that are more sort of on the frontiers. So today I'm going to talk about gravitational instantons, or in other words, tunneling processes which include gravity. So previously, when we've sort of talked about quantum mechanical processes, we've been doing it more from a perspective of taking a classical background and just imagining quantum fields living on the classical background, whereas the process of tunneling is sort of in something that really is inherently quantum mechanical. And so to have gravity participating in that process is quite a sort of interesting concept. So that's what we'll see. I'm going to be discussing mainly in detail two older papers. So these are really quite vintage papers now, probably before so at least many of you were born, but they're actually very nice papers and quite readable. So I sort of recommend you go and take a look at them. And what people were thinking about in the late 70s, we've already seen some of the things, the domain wall, for example. People were really starting to think about implications of field theory on the grand scale. So once you get to the grand scale, you have to start thinking about gravity. Although this very first paper did not actually include gravitational effects, it was simply discussing tunneling in quantum field theory. So let's sort of begin by just reminding ourselves what tunneling is. So we'll start with the sort of first time you typically meet tunneling, which is in the context of the Schrödinger equation. And so, you know, you sort of basically solve the Schrödinger equation for all sorts of different potentials. And in this case, you solve it for a potential barrier. And so the notion is that you have some incident particle with energy E. So classically, the particle would just get reflected back off. But of course, quantum mechanically, its wave function won't ever be exactly vanishing unless the barrier is infinite. So the wave function kind of seeps through the barrier and then comes out at the other side. So we have some probability of finding particles that have been transmitted on the other side. So this probability this is usually the only time you ever actually calculate it properly. So here, I've got to tell you what everything is. Our barrier is going to have width d. It's going to have height v naught. E is, of course, the energy of the incident particle. And then omega is given, is really the complex frequency here, or the imaginary frequency under the barrier. So omega d which is the sort of primary behavior of this probability with respect to the parameters, is just given by an integral of, if you like, the barrier. So it's V naught minus the energy. So that's the residual potential barrier. So it's like the area under the barrier, factored with a factor of the mass. So that's basically, you know, you don't actually do that integral. You usually just literally solve the Schrödinger equation and match the wave functions at the boundaries. But the reason I'm doing this is what I want to do now is to give an alternative way that you could have computed that probability. So let's just now consider a classical particle . So I'm going to draw something that's essentially the previous barrier, but flipped. Now we'll see why once I've finished the story. But here, if I just kind of imagine that this depth is just delta V, and I'm going to start my particle, I've kind of softened, you know, the square edges just so that it looks more sensible, doesn't look quite so crazy. But I'm starting my particle just here at rest. It's going to fall down, kind of go up, and then come back again to where it started. So classically, this is a classical problem now, the kinetic energy, you know, is really going to be given by this delta V. So if I think about the integral of root 2 delta V dx, which is kind of thinking about this omega d, but with no h-bars. Then I can turn that into a dt, because 2 delta V is just x dot squared. And then that's a sort of looks like an energy integral, okay? So what does this classical picture have to do with that quantum picture? Well, let's think about we'll sort of relate these. So let's think about what we've done. So if I look at this, say look at a Lagrangian, so this would be a sort of standard one particle Lagrangian. Now I'm going to send t goes to I tau. And I swap the sign of my x dot squared term. But then, this, if I look at just what it's describing in terms of its dynamics, just looks like a particle moving in an inverted well. So the relation here is that this suppression here of the wave function, or the factor by which the wave function is suppressed, is given, so you can see here you've got sort of standard real motion, which is oscillatory. Underneath the barrier, you've got this exponential tail, which is kind of the, you know, motion with an imaginary frequency. So you can think if you Euclideanize, that would sort of turn an imaginary to real. So that's kind of where this is coming from. But the way you actually get it is by just thinking of the taking your Schrödinger wave function and doing a sort of WKB approximation and sort of looking at how, you know, writing psi as e to the I alpha on h bar, and then you see that alpha kind of looks underneath the barrier a bit like one of these classical Euclidean particles. So the main feature main features captured by this classical Euclidean, and it's motion in inverted commas because, of course, it's not really motion if it's in Euclidean time. But it's kind of a trick. It's a trick which mirrors a process that you would use to try and compute the wave function, but it's something which has a very intuitive sort of interpretation. And it's very good, you know, provided the barrier is significant, so that the main contribution from that science shin there is the exponential tail, provided the barrier is sort of, you know, reasonably significant, this is a very good approximation to what's actually going on. So then your tunneling amplitude is sort of given by an exponential, because as I was describing, you're sort of doing a WKB type approximation for your wave function, so you need to exponentiate what you get. So you take the action, so you can see the action of that classical particle, which is kind of what I wrote on the right-hand side, is indeed this root 2 delta V dx. So that's kind of what we need to get the probability. And so we take the action of our classical solution, and this is called a bounce. And so the bounce is simply the trajectory from the metastable point to the sort of where it emerges and back. So the picture, if you had a more general potential where you couldn't do this nice matching that you do with the nice square barrier, so something like alpha decay, you might imagine you're in a local minimum, so that's what we mean by metastable. It's locally stable to small perturbations, but it's not completely stable because you could always imagine kicking it over the barrier. So that's what we mean by metastable. So this is the problem we're sort of asking. So what we do is we invert the potential, like so. And then from the Euclidean perspective, we've started off here and we're looking for a solution which kind of rolls down. Now it's going to roll back up to a sort of similar point and then it comes back again. That's the Euclidean solution. That's why it's the bounce going there and back again. And then this, on the other hand, you sort of imagine it's kind of, it goes across here, and then suddenly it emerges at the other side, and then it can evolve classically. So that's the picture. So there's no real classical, fully, you know, there's no sort of even pseudo-classical description of the process before the particle appears on the other side of the potential well, but we usually kind of imagine that we patch together, we have our sort of Euclidean solution, tau goes to minus infinity is this, the solution that's going from here to here. We cut at tau equals zero, and then we go we then sort of patch it onto the classical solution. Mm-hmm.
So could you just repeat the
Euclidean motion
on the...
So the Euclidean motion, it's a particle starting off, you know, the gradient zero there, right? So it's that's why you kind of go back to t equals minus infinity. But you sort of imagine that your actual solution is going to be something where the particle rolls down, it rolls up till it stops, and then it rolls back again. It's sort of, strictly speaking, you know, if you've got everything minutely balanced as one can with classical motion, goes straight back.
So, but if you look at the real-time the particle is at in the metastable state, right?
Initially, so which is that, yeah.
Oh, but on the left-hand side, you drew it in a... it's flipped.
Yeah, it's flipped. Yes, yes, yes. So this is, if you like, T, and this is tau, Euclidean. So, yeah, so, I mean, at T equals zero over here, it emerges with zero velocity. Well, again, you know, it's only a picture. So let's now, that's particles, okay? But we want to deal with field theory, so let's actually look at what Coleman did. Okay, so he was thinking about false vacuum decay. So I'm going to imagine, we've seen this before or something like it, I've got a scalar field which has an interaction, some self-interaction potential. And I'm going to say that my V is something like, just for the cases of this argument, so it's very similar to the domain wall that we saw. It's a double well potential, but we've added a sort of little shift term such that one of the potential wells has a slightly higher energy than the other. So epsilon is being used to indicate something small because I'm going to ignore it at some point in this discussion. So this point, phi is minus eta, is what we call a false vacuum. And the reason is, dependent on, of course, the energy barrier, we're in a locally stable point. If we started to quantize around that particular point, we might start off being okay, in that there's going to be various states that are localized around there. Obviously, as we went to higher and higher energies, we then start to get, you know, sort of see that something wasn't quite right. So as long as you're only ever dealing with low energy states, this looks like it's a legitimate vacuum. So that's why we call it the false vacuum. On the other hand, phi equals eta. So here, V is epsilon. Phi equals eta is what we call a true vacuum, because it's actually the global minimum of the energy. So we would discover that we really should be quantizing around the true vacuum if we did things in full. So this false vacuum state is metastable. If we start off by putting a particle localized there, it'll stay there at least for a decent amount of time because of the huge potential barrier. So I'm just going to abbreviate false vacuum by FV. So let's look at calculating, or at least, you know, estimating what that time is for the vacuum to decay. So we saw that with a single particle, we could do this by Euclideanizing. So let's do that here. So this would be my Euclidean equation of motion. So if I sketch my configuration, The box is just sort of, it's not real, okay? So I've got false vacuum here. This is kind of my tau direction. These are my spatial directions, x. And I'm going to sort of think now, what would a bounce solution be in this particular circumstance? I wouldn't expect to be able to make the whole of my false vacuum simultaneously hop over into the true vacuum, because there is a potential barrier, and that would mean lifting all of space over that barrier. So I don't really expect to be able to do this process everywhere in space, because otherwise that would be an infinite energy cost. What I might be able to do, though, is I might be able to take some region of space over to the true vacuum. So if I think about what this is doing, this is like a phase transition. We're going from one phase to another phase. We're changing the expectation value of our scalar field. So what happens in a phase transition? Well, the ones that we're actually most familiar with are first order phase transitions, like boiling water. And so what happens when you boil water? You get bubbles of steam. So, motivated by that, you might expect a bubble of true vacuum to form. So that's sort of the expect, or this is a very, at the moment, just a heuristic kind of argument. So let's think, does that make sense as a bounce? Well, if I go down to tau equals minus infinity, I'm completely in the false vacuum, sort of there. Tau is plus infinity, false vacuum, there. Tau equals zero, what do I have? Well, at tau equals zero, I've got a configuration where I've got a bubble of this true vacuum sitting inside. So I have exited. I know I can't exit everywhere because that would be just too much, too expensive. But I have managed to exit in a region of space where that area or the volume of the region is maximal. So this actually does make sense as a bounce, if you know, in terms of an interpretation. Why would it be circular? Well, we'll sort of see when we go through Coleman's argument. There's a sort of balance going on here. The barrier, or the region between the true vacuum and the false vacuum, the scalar field has to go over that potential barrier. So as we know from when looking at the domain wall, that costs, that gives you some energy momentum. So there's an energy associated with this wall. And then that comes with a factor of the area of the wall. On the other hand, inside, we've gone from false vacuum to true vacuum. So we've released energy by going from the epsilon state down to zero. So you can see there's kind of a bit of payoff going on here between the energy that we gain from releasing the false vacuum to the energy that we lose from making the wall. And so, as we know, spherical bubbles sort of maximize that payoff. They maximize the internal volume for the given surface area. So that's kind of a justification, and it's more or less the justification that Coleman used as to why these are spherical walls. So, that was a lot of talking. So we expect things to depend on this rho, which is the Euclidean radial distance, which is tau squared plus x squared. So the equation of motion for phi I'm now going to drop the epsilon term. I'm going to say, I mean, here I'm going to do this sort of analytically with approximations, okay? So at this point, I've said this is a small number. My profile is going to be dominated by this part of the potential, so I'm going to drop epsilon. So that's my first approximation. So my second approximation is going to be that if the vacuum energy difference epsilon is that small, I'm going to have to make quite a large volume transition in order to buy what, you know, the wall, the membrane that it needs to separate it from the false vacuum. So second approximation, if I call the radius of this bubble rho naught, so that's the sort of physical reason behind it. Epsilon's small, so we expect a large bubble. And therefore, I'm going to say rho naught is large relative to the scales of a problem. And so I'm now going to drop this term, because I'm going to say that everything is happening out near rho naught. So near rho naught, we've got this 1 over rho piece in front of phi prime. So I'm going to say that's irrelevant. And so what we're left with is actually the domain wall profile. Let me put an approximate. Which we derived whenever it was. So obviously I'm going to have to just quickly check that this is self-consistent. But this is at least a good starting point. So this is the sort of thin wall approximation. So let's start looking at what it tells us. If I look at my Euclidean action, I've got my kinetic pieces. So phi prime, I wanted to try and it's really with respect to Euclidean time. So this is a half d phi d rho squared, which is roughly v, okay? So we're seeing this 2v cropping up again. So we have to integrate through the potential barrier. So that's, again, something that corresponds to our quantum mechanical picture. And if I look at where the contribution to this integral is, it's localized on the wall. So in fact, it's going to be given essentially by the area of the wall. Times the tension of the wall. So remember, we actually found that it was this integral of sec to the fourth or whatever when we did the domain wall. So that's the action associated with the wall, but then we've also got to take into account the interior of the walls no longer in the false vacuum. So we've got an energy now of or an energy drop, of minus pi squared on 2 rho naught to the fourth epsilon. So our bounce action is kind of the difference. This is our wall action and then our energy. So these are the competing factors. So if you remember, there was this sort of discussion about playoffs between the cost of forming the wall and the energy that you get back from releasing the false vacuum inside the wall. So here you see that payoff. Now, any solution should be a stationary point. So that means that if I change the size of the bubble, I should be at a local stationary point. So I'm going to vary my action with respect to rho naught. And then I'm going to set that to zero. So what that does is it gives me a relation between rho naught, which is the sort of unknown parameter, and the parameters from coming from the model. So that would be the tension of the wall sigma, which is given in terms of eta and lambda, and the energy difference between the false and true vacuum. So we've got here that rho naught is 3 sigma on epsilon, which gives us a bounce action of essentially proportional to sigma to the fourth on epsilon cubed. So we simply put that value of rho naught into B, and you can see the sigma to the fourth and 1 over epsilon cubed behavior coming in. So that's our action. And you can see that it's sort of how big it is going to be a competition between the wall tension and this energy difference. Now, we assumed epsilon was small. So you can see that this is going to be, in general, a reasonably large number. And apologies for intermittently putting H bars in here, because obviously H bars 1 in this. So let's try and see what we've actually constructed and then see if our approximation is reasonable. So we've got our Euclidean solution, which is what is called the instanton. I guess it's called an instanton because it's centered around this rho equals naught point, which is just an instant in time. So the Euclidean solution is the bubble that we already drew. How does that translate to a real solution? When I drew the particle tunneling through, I kind of drew it suddenly emerging at the other side. What's the equivalent of that from a Lorentzian? So our Euclidean solution has the wall at tau squared plus x squared equals rho naught squared. So if I Lorentzianize that, I would expect that to go to minus t squared plus x squared equals rho naught squared. So that looks like something that we've already seen. It looks like a hyperboloid. So if I once again cut at here at tau equals zero and over here at t equals zero, what I might imagine is that suddenly at t equals zero, a bubble forms and then it starts to accelerate off with uniform acceleration. So that's what I might expect. I analytically continue my Euclidean solution to Lorentzian space to get the subsequent evolution of my bubble. So if I put those two pictures together, this is my Lorentzian evolution. Here we chop at t equals naught. And then I kind of patch it to a Euclidean solution. So that's just one way of thinking about it. Mm-hmm. Sorry? Yes, we do. Actually, I don't think I wrote it down in my notes. I'm sorry. We've got sigma. Maybe I've written it down later. If I have written it down, it'll come in when I'm talking about the gravity. So sigma, as I was saying, is related to, it's proportional, I think, to root lambda eta cubed. It's just the integral of V through the wall. Yeah, it's the energy integrated energy per unit area of the wall. So it's not an unknown. And that's why we know that sigma is in fact bigger than epsilon within this approximation. So here we sort of got a bubble of vacuum forming. So just notice that our rho naught, which was 3 sigma on epsilon, since we took epsilon to be small, it does actually agree with our approximation of saying that rho naught was big. So it's completely self-consistent, you know, whether it agrees with some particular field theory Lagrangian that you have and whether it's physically relevant is a different matter. So it is a self-consistent approximation. So I just want to compare this to the domain wall. So what we looked at was a domain wall self-gravitating. And that looked like one of these hyperboloids. So in that case, what we're calling rho naught here was 1 over 4 pi g sigma. So it's, you know, it's sort of slightly different. But let's see how these two things play together. So this is gravitating, and this is not. So let's think about if we want to make our field, our little decay of the false vacuum gravitationally consistent, what do we have to do? So we've got a false vacuum. Our false vacuum has energy epsilon. So it actually has a lambda, which means it's not flat space. So that tells us that our false vacuum must be de Sitter space. So let's try and just imagine what we've got to construct. So our idea is that, again, if I sort of even more sort of cautiously draw a box, I'm trying to imagine constructing a flat solution. So this is the true vacuum, which should be Minkowski space-time, because V is zero. Outside, on the other hand, I've got to construct de Sitter space-time. So that's the Euclidean picture that I'm looking for. Lorentzian, well, okay, it is a bit different from what we did, but given the approximations, the length scale of de Sitter remember was given by the inverse cosmological constant. So here my de Sitter length scale L is equal to 3 over 8 pi g epsilon, or the square root of 3 over 8 pi g epsilon. So I've got quite a large length scale for my de Sitter. So it's not flat, but it's not far off flat. So our domain wall previously was vacuum to vacuum with a hyperboloid. So it's not unreasonable that there might be something looking very close to that picture with Minkowski space-time inside and de Sitter space-time outside. So it doesn't look implausible, but I have to go and make sure that I can construct it. So here, we're going to do another application of those Israel conditions. We're going to look for a solution to Einstein's equations with precisely those properties. Something which is vacuum Minkowski on one side, de Sitter on the other side, and where we stitch a boundary, we make a boundary of the Minkowski, a boundary within the de Sitter, such that the two boundaries have the same induced metric, and the jump in extrinsic curvature is going to give us the sigma, the domain wall tension. So let's go ahead. So inside, this is where lambda is zero. We've got just flat space. So that's our flat space, same row as before. Mm-hmm. With the what, sorry? So we did the Israel conditions yesterday, did we? Yeah. So you just have to look back. Yeah. So if our wall is at row naught, I mean, I'm not doing them yet. I'm just saying this is, we're going to apply this method. So So the wall is at row naught, and it has an outward normal of d by d rho. So the outward normal is just radially pointing. So my k alpha beta So the alpha and beta are the angles. I'm just, you know, looking at the the angles are, of course, the only coordinates on the boundary. So that's what we've got inside, outside. Here we've got de Sitter, so lambda's 8 pi g epsilon. So I'm writing now de Sitter, Euclidean de Sitter looks like a four sphere. And so I'm simply saying that it's I've got a unit four sphere metric scaled by this L, where L's related to epsilon. So here, my wall is now at chi naught. And my normal, which is going to be 1 over L d by d chi, is again, now it's a sort of inward normal because it's pointing into my bulk space. So I'm using the Israel conditions. So here I've got my normal being continuous across the boundary. It's always pointing radially outwards. So my K So the reason I've chosen these coordinates is so that I can directly say that the angles on the inside are the same as the angular coordinates on the outside. And the only coordinates that are changing are the radial coordinates. And the radial coordinate is what's kind of making the geometry curve in the case of De Sitter. So if I patch these two together, means I have to identify rho naught with some value of chi naught. And so I do that by saying the two metrics have to be the same. So I see that rho naught is L sine chi naught. So I get a direct relation between the radial coordinates on each side. Now I apply Israel conditions. So the Israel conditions relate, if you just remember, we have the jump in extrinsic curvature is related to the energy momentum tensor. Now the energy momentum tensor for a wall is proportional to the metric, and luckily our extrinsic curvatures are proportional to the metric. So we simply take delta KAB minus delta K. So K here is simply going to be 3 cot chi naught on L. So when I take K plus AB minus delta K, I'm going to get minus 2 cot chi naught on L. And so this is what my Israel condition gives me. So it gives me a constraint for rho naught, because of course cos chi naught is, I can rewrite that in terms of rho naught. But I'm not going to do that yet because it's actually quite useful to keep the chi's in here for calculating the Euclidean action. So the Euclidean action here I've got my bulk Einstein terms on each side. I've got something telling me about the energy of the wall. And then, of course, I've got to take into account my Gibbons-Hawking terms in each case. And I just have to flip the sign of the K minus term because I've changed the sign of the normal. I've made it outward pointing, not, not inward. So so one thing I just want to point out here is that all we're doing now is going ahead and calculating the bounce action. Notice I haven't done any d by d rho naught or whatever. So if you do the field theory bounce in flat space, you have to actually use an argument about stationarity of the action to deduce what the value of rho naught is. Here, the Israel conditions have told us how big the bubble is. So we don't have to do any variation gravitationally, geometrically. The system is completely prescribed. So we sort of, once we include gravity, it gives us the radius straight off. So in some sense, very direct sense, I suppose, what the Israel conditions are doing are they're telling you how you're allowed to patch between de Sitter and flat space. So it is doing that tuning for you. It's saying if you make the bubble too small, you can't patch the things together with that tension. If you make it too big, again, you can't patch them together with that tension. So gravity does that for you once you allow it in. So my bounce action, I've got to take the instanton configuration, and then I've got to subtract off the background, just like I did before. So without the wall, the background configuration is just de Sitter space everywhere. The instanton, on the other hand, has de Sitter space on the outside, so m plus there is going to be chi bigger than chi naught. So that obviously cancels off with the background subtraction. But what doesn't cancel off is the bit on the inside. So that's for chi less than chi naught. And then the other pieces that I get from the instanton, but not from the background, are, of course, the boundary terms. So that's delta k on 8 pi g. And, of course, the sigma coming from the wall energy momentum. So this is my calculation. R for de Sitter is minus 4 lambda here. So I get my volume integral there. Well, my volume factor is L to the fourth sine cubed, and I've got a 2 pi squared coming from the area of the three spheres. Meanwhile, here, delta K, if I look at what my Israel conditions give me, my delta K is going to be minus 12 pi g sigma. So I get sort of minus 3/2 sigma coming from this piece. So I've got minus sigma over 2, and then the area of the wall. So it is looking quite similar to the flat space result, but it's just sort of a few little sneaky differences. So I'll do the integral. So I can relate L. Remember, L squared is 3 on 8 pi g sigma. So I can get rid of that epsilon. 3 over 8 pi g epsilon. So I can get rid of this epsilon here. My apologies, that stops there. And then, of course, I can replace my rho naught with with sine chi naught. It's there somewhere, middle of the bottom board there. And so this all boils down to pi L squared on 4G, 1 minus cos chi naught all squared. So again, I mean, that doesn't give it to you in terms of the physical variables, but you can see that it's actually, you know, reasonably nice expression. If I want to rewrite it in terms of other... So I've chosen to write it here in terms of the length scale of De Sitter. But you could ask, well, what happens as g goes to zero? Well, as g goes to zero, if you, obviously the term in this term in square brackets goes to zero, so you just end up with one there. It looks like the action goes to zero, but here's your sigma to the fourth that you've got with Coleman de Lucia, sorry, with just Coleman. And then you've got an L to the sixth G cubed. But of course, L squared has a 1 over G in it. So L to the sixth G cubed is just 1 over epsilon cubed with some factors. So indeed, this is Coleman's result, but with gravity put in. So what does it look like if I start sketching things? Well, De Sitter space is a sphere. So here we've got our Euclidean picture. And Minkowski space is flat. So I've cut my sphere off at some given radius, chi naught. So here this would be chi naught. And I've replaced it with flat space. So I take a sphere and just chop it. So this is Minkowski space-time. So this is the Coleman de Lucia instanton, or a picture of it. So what if I go to ask what my, or a counterpart of my Lorentzian picture is? Well, I should have a hyperboloid. And so here we've got Minkowski space-time. This is De Sitter. So I'm embedding my De Sitter space in a five-dimensional space. You did this in a tutorial. And then once again, I chop my hyperboloid and replace it with just a little piece of flat space. So that's my Lorentzian picture. And so the whole sort of interpretation of Coleman de Lucia is to kind of put these two together, which really does challenge me. Hope you can sort of see what I mean by that. So that is a picture that at t equals naught, a bubble nucleates inside De Sitter space and expands, and you could imagine sort of patching that on to the Euclidean picture, you know, for sort of t less than naught. It's only a sketch. It's a cartoon of what's going on. So just to wrap up, I'm just going to sort of tell you about some work that I've been doing recently, which takes this picture and adds black holes and gives a somewhat different result. So initially, Ian Moss and Ben Withers and I took this Coleman de Lucia picture and added black holes. So we've seen how to do a black hole. A black hole is going to not spoil the symmetry of the bubble because we can put a black hole at the center. So why do this? Well, typically, if you think about first order phase transitions, they're rarely occurring in a perfect medium with perfect symmetry. Usually, bubbles actually condense and pop out centered on impurities. So you know, if you've got if you have a pan or you pop some mug in the microwave, heat your water up, pop a tea bag in, suddenly the whole thing fizzes. And it's basically by adding something to the fluid, you've kind of catalyzed the phase transition. So this is where this is coming from. And so if you add a black hole to the process, all you're doing is you're saying that you're taking Schwarzschild de Sitter or Euclidean Schwarzschild de Sitter on one side and then patching it with either Schwarzschild or just a pure vacuum space-time. And so what we've done, we've already got all the tools to actually answer this question. So you can see that it's going to look similar to what I've written down, but obviously the details of the bubble are going to be just slightly different. So what we found was the black hole did indeed catalyze tunneling. So generically, black holes lower this action and so make increase the probability. And so our picture, if you like, Schwarzschild de Sitter, if we want to just tunnel to a sort of flat space, this would be our cosmological horizon. So there was some technicalities in there about dealing with conical deficits, but it turns out you can compute these actions. And so potentially B bounce is much less than the Kalman-De Lucia value if sigma is small, and it sort of depends again on masses, etc., etc. And so more recently we've applied this to the Higgs vacuum, because, well, I hope they're going to discuss it in standard model. Basically, it seems quite interesting. If we look at the running of the coupling constant of the Higgs based on sort of standard model parameters, there's a bit of uncertainty in the top mass, and it seems that the coupling of the Higgs at high energies depends very sensitively on the Higgs mass and on this uncertainty of the top mass. So we get kind of this running of the potential. So V, or if we just choose a sort of single component of the Higgs, it looks something like this, where lambda has a sort of logarithmic running with scale. Now, what it seems is that we are in a region, or very close to a region, where lambda star is actually negative. So it looks like our vacuum becomes, you know, unstable at high energies. So our current vacuum is metastable. Now, given these parameter values, you might say, well, can't I add some sort of quantum gravity type of correction, etc., to stabilize the vacuum? You can, but again, you still have an issue. There might be a second minimum now at negative cosmological constant. So normally people say, well, we don't have to worry about tunneling because Kalman-De Lucia says it's okay. So we've gone and looked at what happens with the black hole, and at least within the thin wall approximation, if you need fairly small black holes to catalyze this decay. So clearly Hawking radiation is an issue, but we kind of look at how the Hawking radiation varies with mass. And it seems as if you've got these Higgs potentials, then primordial black holes that would be evaporating now would actually not so much evaporate for certain regions of parameter space. They'd catalyze one of these catastrophic vacuum decays. So it's an old result of Kalman and De Lucia's, but it doesn't mean that there's not actually some new physics hidden in there, some gravitational physics in the form of black holes, and actually possibly with some applications, sort of given what we don't know, at least, about the Higgs vacuum at the moment. So this is kind of, you'd never think that, you know, gravity and black holes could have anything to do with Higgs phenomenology. Well, they probably don't, but at least, you know, this is kind of an interesting story. Okay.